I'm going to turn it over to two of our affiliate members, which is Dr. Yvette Reed and Dr. Ruby Kane, as they will lead and guide us in the direction as we focus on our future.
Thank you, Lee. Good morning, everyone. My name is Dr. Yvette Simmons Reed. I'm an assistant professor at the Ball State University.
And good morning. I am Dr. Ruby Kane, associate professor of practice at Ball State University. We are extremely happy to be here today on behalf of the Diversity and Inclusion Committee of the National Federation of the Blind, Indiana. And we will be providing a overview or I would call it like part one of a diversity presentation, and we're calling this intersectionality of cultural identities. We'd like to start with the mission and vision statement for the Diversity and Inclusion Committee of the National Federation of the Blind of Indiana. The mission statement is: the National Federation of the Blind of Indiana's Diversity and Inclusion Committee is committed to promoting equity and inclusion of a diverse global community. Our diverse community includes, but is not limited to, the intersectionality of ability, age, religion, race, ethnicity, culture, gender identity or expression, and sexual orientation. We are committed to honoring the lived experiences of those with congenital and acquired blindness, those with different geographic backgrounds, different languages, labor, and socioeconomic status in the exchange of ideas, opinions, and actions. Through advocacy, awareness, and educational activities, we strive to advance policies and practices that cultivate a climate of awareness and understanding, acceptance, and opportunities for advancement and respect for the dignity of all people. The vision statement is: our vision is to broaden the scope of awareness and understanding of the definition of full inclusion, to explore and expand on the cultural makeup of the organization, providing education and training, guidance and advocacy where needed. Our goal is to cultivate a federation that is diverse, equitable, and inclusive of all, while maintaining the purpose and overall mission of the NFB as primary advocates for the blind community. At this time, we want to get started with an activity. And when we're talking about cultural differences, a good place to start is what we have in common. Even though we do have differences, we really are more alike than we are different. And sometimes we get hung up on those differences and have a difficult time in communicating with each other. So I like to start in addressing those things that we do have in common, so we really forge that bond that we have before we address those things that are different. So how are some of the ways that we might determine what we have in common? And I've included a few examples here, and I'd like to start with music. And what I'll do before we open it up to the audience is Dr. Evie and I will talk about what we have in common with music. Now, I grew up in Detroit, and I am very much into the R&B and the Motown sound. And so my favorite artist is the Four Tops. And when I had my last birthday party, I called it Motown in the 60s. And we dressed up like the 60s and we played Motown music. That's how much I like it. I also like gospel music. And I attended a church in Detroit growing up where a lot of the gospel acts from all over the country would come. Dr. Evie.
Now, what's interesting, although I did not grow up in the 60s, I was born toward the end of the 60s. I am the youngest of 11 children. And so I got to hear a lot of rhythm and blues. So again, my favorite music is listening to rhythm and blues. I was born in Cleveland, Ohio, home of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but it wasn't there yet. And so my first album I bought at 10 years old, and then notice I said album, we were still using those, was Smokey Robinson. And so at 10 years old, I remember being so excited about that. And I love gospel. We spent a lot of time in church, singing. I sung in the choir. And just listening to gospel music, I find it inspirational and uplifting. So
Dr. Evie, how much did that first album cost?
I haven't a clue. I just know it was, I was so proud. It was Smokey Robinson and Chic. Those were the two.
Well, guess what my first album was?
How much? I mean, what?
Who it was.
Who it was?
What artist?
I should know.
I just
don't
know who my favorite was.
The Four Tops?
Yes, the Four Tops. And I remember $4.25.
Wow.
And I had to save my allowance probably for about a month before I had the $4.25. So what we want to do is open it up to the audience. And you can either write your favorite music in the chat, or if you'd like to speak it, that's good too. Whatever your choice is.
You can just unmute yourself.
Well, individuals cannot unmute themselves. They'd have to raise their hand.
Oh, so then they have to write it in the chat.
Or write it in the chat, yes.
We have participants who've raised their hand.
Yeah, I'm on the phone, so I can't write in the chat. But
okay, so can you tell us what's your favorite?
Yeah, my favorite type of music is contemporary Christian, and I also like Clackle.
Oh, okay, wonderful.
All right, awesome.
Thank you. Okay, in the chat we have Country and Pop by Abby, and then Classical and Michael Jackson. Oh, I like Michael Jackson too. Folk music, soft rock from the 70s, and contemporary Christian current from Tammy. And Mark had folk. And then Jennifer has folk and mellow rock. Jessica, R&B and rap, and she loves jazz. I love jazz as well. My favorite instrument of jazz artists is the electrical violin.
This is Michael Off. I made my own style called Raz, which is a mix of rock and soul.
All right. Raz. I like that. Jessica said, I love R&B and rap. I love jazz too. That's the last one I got in the chat so far. Were there any on the phone that wanted to share?
Sarah, I am not on the phone. I'm through Zoom, but, I love music. I love contemporary Christian worship music. But also love like folk music, acoustic music, classical, jazz, pop. The only kinds of music I personally don't like are like heavy metal, screamo, and really intense country music.
Right.
And this is Lee.
Yes.
And I like an assortment of music. I do like, believe it or not, some country. I love jazz. I even like some old Muddy Waters and Isaac Hayes. And and I think I really first fell in love with Smokey Robinson and then Isaac Hayes and the Spinners and the Delphonics and Blue Magic and all of those. And you sit back and write all my love letters as a teenager back then. So yes, those are some of the musics that I like.
Recognize all of those. I like country too. Some country, not all country, but a lot.
Not all.
And Jennifer, New Age and World. She likes so many different types of music. Dorothy wrote R&B, blues, and country. Diane says, I am what you would call eclectic. I like it all. Yeah. Carolyn, Temptation songs, I guess, maybe. The Temptations. And there's one person, I'm not sure, D2, maybe. I second Sarah about heavy metal music. Diane says, I am what you, okay, eclectic. I think I got that one. Abby, I agree with Sarah about metal too. And Tammy, I agree. I love music, but not heavy metal. So, thank you so much for sharing your interests. And we could do this for a number of different things, but in the interest of time, we're going to move on just in a second here. But I think one of the things that I want to emphasize is even though we're uniquely different from one another, we often bond on what we have in common. So that particular activity made me smile and made me reminisce. And, you know, I have a very good feeling right now. And I think another example of what everyone on the call today has in common, including me, I am an NFB member as well as all of you. And NFB members are congenitally blind, adventitiously blind, low vision, visually impaired, and or advocates of those who are. So within your organization, you will be talking about and creating policy to increase the equity among those communities that we just talked about that are predominantly your membership. So we do have many ways in which we can bond. And if we just think about some of the things that we easily have in common, and usually we don't get a chance to talk about that. You know, I don't think I've ever talked about my music at work, but I do talk about it in the community and in my family. Dr. Evie will cover rules of engagement. You're muted, Dr. Evie.
Hold on. Oh.
Dr. Reed? We Zoom seems to be having some problems, so those of you who will be speaking regularly, we would suggest, especially in a quiet environment, just to keep yourself unmuted once you get in that status. There's Zoom is
okay. I'm here. I'm sorry, I didn't realize it muted me. I tried to keep it unmuted. So to get started, so we can be on the same page and hear other people's perspectives, we always start with these rules of engagement. Everyone gets a fair hearing. Share the air.
Dr. Evie?
Yes.
We have a question in the chat that I think you should address before we continue.
Okay, go ahead.
This is from Sarah. Can you please describe adventitiously blind and how this is different from congenital blindness?
Adventitiously blind would be those who lost their vision during their lifetime, not those who were born blind. We also call that acquired blindness. Is that...
Thank you.
Okay. So in terms of our rules of engagement, is it share the air? We want to keep our minutes, our comments to 1 minute or less and allow those who have not shared an opportunity to do so. Speak for yourself and not for others. Seek to understand before being understood. And that's an important one when we're talking about sometimes these are difficult conversations for individuals. So we always want to seek to understand before we're understood.
I'd like to say something else about that, Dr. Evie. A lot of times when we have conversations and when we're talking and a person says something we don't agree with, we spend our energy in countering what they said and trying to get them to come over to our side. And what we would like in these types of cross-cultural dialogues is for you not to focus on getting your point across, but focus on understanding the perspective that person has who differs in opinion with you. So some of the things you might want to do is ask, why do you feel that way? And get a better understanding. And a good example of this is when I moved to Indiana, I was born in Arkansas, raised in Detroit, and I moved back to Arkansas, then to California, and I was in Southern California and then the Bay Area and back to Southern California before moving to Indiana. And Indiana's culture was significantly different from any that I had been in before. And so what I needed to know is, why is it different? Not that it's bad or that it's good, but why is it something that I have not experienced before? And gaining that better understanding helped me to appreciate the culture in Indiana. Thank you, Dr. Evie.
That's an excellent example. Agree to disagree. It's okay that you don't share the same opinion. If you are offended, say so and say why if you can. That just helps the conversation. Do not take it personally. Stick to the issues.
I'd like to go back to, if I may, Dr. Evie, to not take it personally. And a lot of times when someone says something to me, and I interpret it a certain way, and I might interpret it as an insult or a put down, And what I've learned is that if I ask that person, why did you say that? And then they explain it. It's nothing as dire as I thought it was. And it really didn't have a lot to do with me in the first place. So when people say things that, you know, sends your guard up or kind of raises your blood pressure, step back a little bit and think about whether or not it's really about you. And it could be just their perspective of what they're talking about, and it's not even a personal issue. And
I think that happens a lot in email communications and those kind of things. People, you know, and their writing style sometimes, you know.
Yeah. And one of the things that I do, you know, and particularly with email, is this: I don't understand. Can you elaborate? And that gives me a better understanding of what
they truly does do that.
And I have a friend, I'm African American. I didn't say that about myself. And my friend, she's white and she's from Indiana. And we went through our doctorate program together. We lived in Fort Wayne at the time and traveled to Ball State. And, we would have a lot of differences of opinions because of our different cultures. And we would talk about that. And if she got upset about something, it says, it's really not about you. And we would laugh, and she said, but it's always supposed to be about me. So if we could be lighthearted about it, we could actually get to a better understanding.
Yes. Are you ready for the definitions, Dr. Kane?
Yeah, I'm trying to. Oh, there we go. So when we talk about race and cultural differences, it's really good to ground that with the definition so we're all on the same page. So we present these definitions to you to just frame the rest of our conversation for today. And racism or cultural oppression is the power of one group in society to systematically oppress those of another group based on color or cultural difference. So it involves racial or cultural prejudice plus societal power, and that's what racism or cultural oppression is. Many people, when they say the word you're racist or you're biased, they're really talking about racial prejudice or cultural prejudice. And racism also involves that plus societal power. So we're looking at how, you know, infrastructures or systems or policies work in a way that disadvantages a full culture group. Structural racism or cultural oppression, it breeds and perpetuates conditions in which the non-majority groups lack power, authority, autonomy, and decision-making capacities. So some examples of that is, who sits on your governing boards? Is it representative of the cultural diversity of your constituents? In many cases, this is not true. You know, in many of our governmental entities, in many of the boards of major corporations or not-for-profit organizations, and what usually happens is they may do a survey in order to get that information. But if you don't have that cultural diversity at the decision-making table, the decisions that are made will be made from the cultural lens of those who are there, and without even intending it, it could possibly be disadvantageous to one or more culture groups. White or majority culture privilege, it's unearned advantages provided by unjust social, political, and legal structures, systems, and institutions. So when we talk about white privilege, majority culture privilege, you may not even be aware that you have it. However, those who don't have it tend to be glaringly aware because they are the recipient of that disadvantage. So when you look at, one of the things I do in my classes is I have students really reflect and analyze their cultural identities, and that includes the white cultural identity. And many people who are white don't think that they have a white cultural identity. And a part of that cultural identity, even though you don't think about it or you don't talk about it, will involve some level of privilege. Internalized racism or internalized cultural oppression, this is where the individuals who are not a part of the majority culture co-opt values of that culture that operate to subjugate others, and it's also in deference to their own culture. So this can even result in self-hatred because you're attempting to assimilate or aspire to the majority culture, but yet there's something about you where you're either visual, you know, by the color of your skin, or something else could be, you know, your accent, that prevents the majority culture from viewing you as a part of them. Implicit bias is unconscious cognition, and this could be action, understanding, or decision that activates involuntarily beyond individual's awareness or intentional control.
This is Susan, and I have a question. As a blind person, sometimes I can't tell by listening to a person's voice whether they're Caucasian or African American or whatever they are. So what's a good way to ask? I mean, sometimes I just hate to come out and be blunt. I have a very funny story about a friend that I was going to room with, and she listened to R&B music. She had her music on, and you know. As I'm sitting there and she's gone to run an errand, I'm thinking, I don't know whether she's white or black, and not that it matters. I'm happy to room with her no matter what, but I just want to know. And so then her mother came in, and I kind of, you know, I did tell her about this later, but when I heard her mother speak, then I knew I could tell at least part of the story. But anyway, what's a good way to ask if you're not sure?
Dr. Evie, would you like to respond to that? Because
but it would be my opinion only.
Right.
I'm fairly direct. So if I would want to know that, I would just say, you know, I would ask them something about themselves. Like, you know, I'm African American, you know, blah, blah, blah. I grew up and blah, blah, blah. Does that make sense? So I may talk about something that would raise that conversation. You know, I grew up in African. If you're introducing right. yourself, you normally tell what church you went. Well, at least African American, and you know, with African American women, the first conversation when we introduce ourselves, we're talking about what church we attend and all that kind of stuff. So,
right. You know, and I like to say too that sometimes, you know, like I am sighted and I can't tell sometimes. So I would probably say, if you don't mind, or do you mind if I ask you, about your race?
Yeah.
And I really like Dr. Evie's response, identifying what she is before asking that question. Diane wrote in the chat, I will just say that I have experienced the self-hatred factor in reversal. I have a very hard time accepting myself as a Caucasian when I am a recipient of that unjust privilege. And actually, I've got a slide that comes up a little bit later about the racial identity development stages, and that what you're experiencing is normal, and it's a process of going through the racial identity development. So you're not alone. Many people feel that way, but once you become more aware of ways, if you are interested in being a part of advocacy, as you become more aware of ways in which you can be an advocate, you can move past that stage. Yeah. But when I teach in my classes, the students go through that as well. You know, the first stage is like denial, and then it's like, you know, feeling ashamed or embarrassed, or why didn't I know, or why, you know, that type of thing. But it is very, it is very common. Sarah said, I love to get to know people and their backgrounds. And since I can't see, would you mind if I ask what race, ethnicity you identify as and how this impacts your life? It's a very good example.
Excellent, Sarah. Mm-hmm.
And I have another person with their hand raised, and I'll see if I can unmute them.
Hi, I'm Ronald Jerome Berg.
Yes.
Good morning. My respect for cultural relativity and cultural assimilation requires that I be as diplomatic as possible. However, for me, if I want to know what your ethnicity is, I ask, would you mind telling me what your ethnicity is? I'd like to know. And provided, hopefully, that I have learned the sensitivity of the person I'm speaking. But I think what I'd like to recommend is that we not be troubled by it. If we want to know it, we want to know it. And if it offends the other person, you know, we can later, you know, maybe apologize and give an explanation. But if it is that important, I don't have any issue with asking, you know, what is your ethnicity? If we want to know anything else, no matter what it's about, we just ask bluntly. So sometimes I think we make more out of the racial acceptance issue or the rebellion, make more out of it than probably we should. So that would be my recommendation is get it behind you, ask the question, and you'll know by the answer whether they were offended or whether it's okay, and then you can fix it if you need to. But to spend so much time trying to see how to be diplomatic, since I'm not the Secretary of State or somebody trying to reconcile people or countries together to do whatever as it relates to individuals, I just try to be as frank, as sensitive, and as loving and as kind as I can. And we're pretty diversified at NFB. And we have diverse personalities, and we, down through the years, know when to be bold, when to be blunt, when to be gentle, kind, and all of that. And so the atmosphere today in our country perhaps causes more problems than we're used to having.
Thank you for that.
That is an excellent thing. And, you know, it's okay if you say something and the person is offended. You can let them know that, you know, you didn't mean to offend. And every day I make one mistake or another, you know, Absolutely. But I learn from my mistakes. Mm-hmm. So it's okay to do that. And Sarah writes, white guilt is a real phenomenon. We can't stay stuck in shame, though, and have an opportunity to become allies. And that's absolutely true. Thank you so much for sharing that. There's a cultural identities activity that I use with my classes to and in the community to show people how many things they really do have in common. And we use like ancestral origin. We use generational cultures, religion, denomination, and birth order. And so the first one I'll do is birth order. How many are the oldest of their siblings?
Just raise your hand if you're on
just
the phone.
Just raise your hand.
It's a star 9.
Yep. Okay, so far we have 3 who raised their hand.
Okay.
Okay, how many, and I'm an oldest child too, I mentioned that before. What about middle? So if you're not the oldest and you're not the youngest and there are multiple siblings, raise your hand. Okay, so far we have 6. Okay.
Wow, okay.
More middle. How about, 8, it's gone up a little bit. Yeah. How about how many are the youngest?
I am.
We have 7. 8. Okay, wonderful. And how about the only child? How many are the only child? We have 7, I think, here. What about adopted? How many are adopted? I don't think we have any who are adopted.
Yes, Dr. Reed, I am adopted.
Okay, so 1. So we really confer certain characteristics on those, like the oldest or the middle or the youngest. You know, some of them, you know, the oldest may be the one who is the responsible one or the bossy one. The middle may be the one who's the quiet one. The youngest may be the one we say that is the creative one or the most spoiled, you know, different things like that. Because we are, you know, like short on time, we're not going to actually go through the others. But if you are in what we call affinity groups, what does it feel like to be in an affinity group, to be with people where you share cultural identities? NFB is an affinity group. What is it like to be in an affinity group?
I would say, Dr. Ruby, it's comfortable. It's, you feel like you belong.
Yes, you feel very comfortable in that. What is it like to be the only one of a cultural identity? I would say the opposite of that. It would be uncomfortable, awkward. I'd like to share with you 10 things everyone should know about race. Race has not always been around. It really is a modern idea, and there's no genetic basis for race. It is socially constructed. There is a human subspecies do not exist. Skin color really is only skin deep. The most variation is within and not between races. Slavery predates race. Race and freedom evolved together. Race justified social inequalities as natural. Race is not biological, but racism is real. And color blindness will not end racism. So these are 10 tenets about that everyone should know about race. And many of those are things that, you know, have been either these myths have been perpetuated and institutionalized. When we attempt to have cross-cultural dialogues on race or cultural differences, often we get a heated situation, very uncomfortable, and maybe anger, maybe hurt, and many individuals will shut down and not even want to talk about it because of perceptions of either being threatened or attacked or of disapproval. And ways to counter that, of course, is to establish those ground rules at first, to like we did at the beginning of this presentation, in order to help frame the discussion and also to understand that even though we're discussing this, it doesn't necessarily mean that when we leave the room, we're going to all be on the same page. Some typical reactions when we're talking about perspectives of racism by cultural identities is defensiveness. The idea of disadvantage and advantage challenges the myth of meritocracy. And the myth of meritocracy is the idea that everyone has the same advantages and the same ability to thrive in our communities and in our economy. There's also disassociation, where this really is not my problem. You know, I didn't have anything to do with it. I didn't create the problem. And so, you know, like I would totally withdraw from it. So it's a way of disconnecting. So some of those challenges for having those conversations about race and cultural differences, we look at race as a taboo topic that we know is going to be volatile, so we don't even try to engage. I've already talked about the myth of meritocracy and the denial of personal connection to race. The fact that I didn't do anything to cause the issue that are here, and then varying journey through the racial identity development model, which I talked about a little bit earlier, and I'll show it to you now. The racial identity development model, there are many models that are very similar to what I have here that we'll go through each of those. William Cross created the one for the Black racial identity development model, and Dr. Beverly Tatum, she adapted from his model. So for persons of color, there is what's called the pre-encounter, the encounter, immersion, internalization commitment. It's before you realize that pre-encounter is before you realize that there's something different about you based on your race. The encounter and the immersion is identifying and coming to terms with whether or not you value, you know, you're aspiring to be a part of the majority culture, but not really fitting in, or whether or not you can move toward valuing your own culture and still engaging with the majority culture. And it's very difficult for that to occur if your image, everything you see, everything you're told, the environments that you're in work to disadvantage your culture group or send messages, subliminal messages. It doesn't have to be specifically said that you are less than. And the white racial identity development model is the contact disintegration. So first contact with others, and trying to come to terms with how my whiteness is different than others' racial or cultural identity. So that's the disintegration. And then it's, you start with, like I said, the denial that there is a difference. And then as you understand and become more aware that there really is a difference, you feel ashamed that you didn't know, or, you know, ashamed that you haven't engaged and done anything before. Then you have reintegration, pseudo-independence, immersion, and autonomy. So what I tell my students is that when you come into my class, you will not all be on the same level or stage of the racial identity development model. And when you leave the class, you won't be on the same. But what we hope happens as we go through the semester is that you will move at least one stage, and hopefully more. And then also to increase awareness of and understanding of how you either individually or collectively can engage in advocacy work to eliminate those disparities. Dr. Evie, is there anything you'd like to say about this?
Of the disintegration model? I'm sorry.
Yes. Or moving through the stages of awareness and to advocacy.
I think the only thing I would like to say is my observation in being a community member in one of your classes as a facilitator in one of the classes, and recognizing that the students absolutely engaged in understanding and moving through these models. And I think they, from the conversations from the beginning of the semester to the end of the semester, for some, starting with that guilt, I particularly remember one in the spring, and feeling that, you know, her whole life, you know, she saw people around her being treated unfairly and didn't know what to do about it. And, really from the, and then was able to work through all of that and also share some of her experiences. And by the end of the semester, you know, she really learned and developed and was willing to and wanting more to learn more.
Thank you so much. Yes. I really appreciate you sharing that. So what we're going to do now is revisit implicit bias that was in our definitions, and I'll repeat the definition. It is unconscious cognition, i.e. action, understanding, or decision that is activated involuntarily beyond individual's awareness or intentional control. First, what I'd like to say is implicit bias is universal. We all have implicit biases. We may have implicit biases about different things, but we all have those. And usually it's based on us making a conclusion on a situation or an idea or something else with our limited understanding, lived experiences or perspectives on that. So, and what I'd like to talk about is how this plays out in various arenas, in terms of the research, the quality of care, it plays out in the quality of care a patient receives. Patients of color will receive, and particularly Black and Brown patients, will receive less pain medication when diagnosed with cancer than white patients.
And I think, Dr. Ruby, we can talk about some of the stories we're hearing in this midst of this pandemic, where some African American individuals seeking hospital care are turned away and not given the type of medical treatment or testing where in other places, you know, for those in the majority culture being accepted and getting that treatment sooner than those who are African Americans. That makes sense?
Yes, it absolutely does. And so, and even with individuals with diabetes, Black patients are more likely to receive amputations than white patients. Mm-hmm. And just like you said, you know, sometimes being refused care, yeah, even when they present with the same symptoms. level of encouragement and academic assessment students receive from their teachers. And this happens in terms of, even in the universities, this happens mm-hmm. where students may not be made aware of scholarships. They may not be encouraged in their academic endeavors as to you would make an excellent accountant or whatever it is that they're aspiring to be.
Not being encouraged in the same way
yes.
or having access to the same opportunities. And this definitely happens in the universities, where we know that individuals with disabilities often aren't aware of some of the activities that they can help them gain more work experience. Here at Ball State, we do a lot of immersive learning. And what I've found is a lot of students with disabilities aren't aware of those opportunities like others are.
Right. And I have students who have varying types of differing abilities, and even getting their peers to accept them without placing judgment that they're less than or that they're lazy or that they don't care about their education. And one of the things I tell my students, and even with, you know, the use of technology, you know, I had a online chat forum with them, one of my classes a couple of days ago. And I said, when you come from, you know, the undergrad to the graduate and you've never had an online class and you've never used that technology before, it makes it really difficult for you to engage like a person who has. And what I find is that one or two semesters later, that person is not only leading in being able to fully engage, but they're assisting others because they remember how they were treated before. And if individuals have differing abilities, you know, I do provide them with the information to contact disability services at our university. And we can't disclose what their disability is, but we do make accommodations for that. And I advocate for all of my students to engage with each other where they are, not where you are. Whether or not an individual receives an interview or a promotion, this happens as well. Disparities in police stops, in prosecutorial charging, and in bail and sentencing. And then also decisions on economic, academic, financial, criminal justice, health care, and employment legislation, policies, and practices. And this is because of who actually develops those policies. It's not representative of all cultures. Okay, so we have these biases, all of us, and of course, my bias is not the same as Dr. Evie's, is not the same as yours. So how do we de-bias? How do we get past that? And here are some examples of ways that you could do that. One is encounter stereotypic training. And a good example of this is back in the 70s, and, you know, of course, I'm giving away my age, which, you know, I'm very proud of. As I say, it's far better than the alternative, right?
Yes.
But I worked with a blind computer programmer. Now, when I talk to colleagues through the decades, they've never had that experience. And so they can't see a programmer who is blind. But had they had the experience that I did, it wouldn't be considered an anomaly. It's something that, you know, is possible. And exposing people to counter stereotypic individuals. So, stepping outside of your comfort zone and, interacting in communities and organizations and, gatherings where you're going to be the only one of your culture. I go to, Burmese festivals and I have such a wonderful time and they don't make me feel like I don't belong there. They embrace you. They make you feel as if you're one of them. So any discomfort that I feel going into the room, I don't have it once I'm in the room. And then intergroup contact. Try to expand your circle where you talk with people who do have different cultural identities than you. And my friend who's white that we went to, we went through our doctoral program together. We carpooled together and we're still very, very good friends. So we learned a lot about each other's cultures as we went through our program together, and helped us to both, not just her, but me as well, to overcome some of my implicit biases. Education efforts aimed at raising awareness about unconscious bias, having a sense of accountability, looking at, is there something different about the way you treat one person versus another, particularly when you're in a position of authority? Taking the perspective of others. So instead of presenting what you believe and think, try looking at it from a different perspective. And then engaging in deliberate processing. Is what I'm doing working for everyone, or is it just working for one group of individuals? And what can I do that's different? And this includes even talking to individuals. How can I, what recommendations do you have that that I can do to either make the class better or to make this group more productive or engaging?
I'm sorry, Dr. Ruth, my grandson's having a meltdown, so I'm going to have
okay.
to...
Okay, so this is an activity. We really don't have time to go through it, but I'll ask the question so it can be something you can think about. How do you feel about increasing diversity, race, ethnicity, age, gender, differing ability, class, faith, or something else? How may increasing diversity impact you? And one of the things that many people fear is that if I increase diversity, that means that there won't be a place for me. And that's not the case. There may be an even more need for you, because by advocating for that diversity, you can assist those who have not been at the table be there, and then act as a cheerleader and also help others to understand varying perspectives. What can you do to ensure effective communications with and learning from colleagues, students of varying cultural identities? When looking at racial or cultural context, how much is your life impacted by race or by cultures that are different than yours? And to what extent are you conscious of the impact of race or cultural identities on your life? You know, we could be conscious of just a small percentage of it, maybe unconscious of quite a bit, and then what we call maybe semi-conscious or disconscious. Mm-hmm. This quote is something that I really like. It's from the Reverend Douglas Fitch, who was a former pastor of the Glide Memorial Church. And he says, "We see things not as they are, but rather as we are." So if we take the time to analyze why we hold the perspective that we do, and what does it come from? Does it come from my past, my experiences growing up, my perspectives, what I've read, what I've seen, what somebody has told me? That can help us to expand our cultural awareness. And one of the things my students, they have to do is research their family history and analyze the positionality of race in their ancestry. And so doing a cultural autobiography of yourself, learning more about you, about your cultures, why you are the way you are. And my favorite line in the movie Amistad, if you've seen that, is where Sinke, who was an African who was brought to the Americas along with other Africans to be enslaved, and after the transport of individuals to be enslaved had been banned, and they actually won their case to be able to go back to Africa, and this was a true story, but what he said was, "I call on my ancestors to assist me with this problem that I have now. I call on my ancestors because I am the only reason they existed. So that connection to your ancestors and then that obligation you have to your descendants, understanding how connected you are to your ancestors and what they experienced, what they lived through, what they provided so that you can be where you are today. Studying whiteness is extremely important. We really need to understand white cultural identity. What does it mean in your everyday life? What happens when you go to the store? What happens when you go to work as it relates to a culture of being either white or a person of color? And recommendations for advocacy work and eliminating disparities in the area of policy, assess and address structural racism and cultural oppression in legislative, academic, financial, housing, health, and business practices. Draft legislation to eliminate disparate treatment by race, and even hold town hall meetings. As a community leader, incorporate faith leaders, community members, and community-based participatory research projects. Invite health, academic, business professionals into faith community for education action projects to eliminate disparities. Create planning action teams comprised of community partners as integral members. Are there any other recommendations that you may have?
And I would say, think about the National Federation of the Blind. Are there ways in which we can increase our diversity in this organization, how you can promote those?
We are short on time, and I would like to hear from our national president, Mark Riccobono. He's worked very diligently on this diversity and inclusion within the Federation and within our community as a whole.
Mr. LaRon Carter wrote, "The more we talk with one another, the greater our relationships. It will also raise the way we look at each other. We will have a better understanding." Jennifer has raised her hand.
Yes, hi. This may be a little bit off topic, but I am an English as a second language facilitator, and I mainly work with people from Costa Rica. And, of course, everything that happens in our country is out there on the news all over the place. And it's really hard sometimes. I took classes like yours, and honestly, they were a mind-opening experience. I grew up in a small town, and so when I went to college, it was like, wow. anyway, I really thank you for presenting. This is very interesting. But sometimes they say things, and, you know, I mean, they point out our racism, and I say things like, well, yeah, you're right. But sometimes it's really embarrassing, and it makes me feel ashamed, like spirit-crushing shame, because, you know, I know they're right. And sometimes they say, well, I wanted to go to the U.S., but now I don't know if I want to go anymore. And it's just really sad and heartbreaking for me, because some of the things that's happened in our society have divided us more than united us. So I'm wondering sometimes what I can say to people like that, because, you know, I'm constantly learning every day. And my goal in this life is to become as non-judgmental as I can be. And it's a learning experience. And the older I get, the more I know that I don't know. So anyway, if you could just address that for a little, I'd appreciate it. Sometimes I say things like, well, we're not all that way or something like that. But then I feel that's kind of trite. But, you know.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, and I think, you know, if you talk about there are things that people say that we don't agree with. And it like just like you were saying, it's not everyone. And our country has the gives us the ability to a freedom of expression. And in many cases, change doesn't always happen from the top down. It happens a lot from the bottom up. And so being a part of organizations or entities that build that groundswell for the change that's needed is something that we have that ability in, you know, in the U.S. So we were built on the premise of allowing all voices to be heard. And unfortunately, we now what we see is individuals who don't want to listen to each other, but that's not true of everybody, like you said. And I think it's probably what we're going through right now, is making more individuals aware that we do need to listen to one another.
This is Michael Loff. I want to ask you and Dr. Reed maybe some responses how we might address this kind of issue. I, like many white people, try to reach out and say, color, race doesn't matter to me. But sometimes in the process of doing that, we unknowingly maybe are come across as minimizing it. Like, it doesn't matter, but it does matter. What is a better dialogue, a way to interact and communicate? What's another way to say that may not come across?
One of those 10 tenets of things you need to know about race is that colorblindness will not eliminate the issue. As a person of color, when I walk out my door every day, racism slaps me in the face and I have to be on full alert. I have to, you know, decide how I plan to address it. Will I ignore it? Will I make a comment? You know, those types of things. And if you don't see color, then that means you don't see me, because I have to live in a reality that I am African American in a Eurocentric environment. I'm reminded every day I have to deal with it. And so if you as a white person is saying that it doesn't matter to you, then what it comes off meaning to others is that I don't matter to you.
Okay.
And so one of the things you can do is to increase your knowledge and understanding of where those disparities are.
Yeah, I've had my colleagues walk in my office, something happened in a meeting, and it's very helpful when someone else recognized that what just happened, you know, wasn't exactly equitable or right for everyone in the room. And so acknowledge that person and hear them out. And maybe you can be a bridge.
Right. I went to Ethiopia on an academic collaboration with a university there. And while I was there, and I was there with a white colleague, and she noticed how the interaction with me and interaction with her was slightly different, or distinctly different. They were friendly to her, very friendly, but it was far more personal with me. And what I noticed was my level of anxiety and distress just was totally eliminated. I felt very comfortable. My blood pressure was always, you know, right where it needed to be. And so when I came back, I said, I now know what privilege feels like, and I like it, you know, so I can understand a lot better now than I could before.
This is an ongoing process and procedure. I have President Mark Riccobono.
Well, thanks, Lee. This is Mark Riccobono. I will say thank you to our facilitators for bringing your authentic expertise to this conversation. This is a really important conversation, and I am humbled by the leadership in Indiana taking this on and supporting this effort to explore these questions. Diversity is really critical to the future of this organization and what we want to see in terms of membership. Now, diversity has been important to us, but it's really essential today, and it's an essential conversation to what the future of membership in this movement looks like. And there's so many challenging questions here, as have already been exposed today. But I think in the true spirit of Federationists, we don't shy away from the hard questions. And I think we are better when we work through these things together. I know that I'm challenged every day to recognize what I have missed in my own journey and what I'm still trying to understand. The thing that I would offer to this group is to continue to promote the idea that diversity is critical to what we do as an organization. It has to be in the fabric of who we are going forward. And B, that there's no such thing as blind people are blind to color. That's just not true. And we need to beat that myth back. And we need to recognize and expose the fact that as blind people, we are as susceptible to implicit bias as anyone else. And we need to figure out how to uncover those conversations and have them. I guess there is a C, which is I would offer within this movement that we should give each other enough grace to recognize that we're going to make mistakes on this journey and to have those honest conversations. You know, we are a family, which means all of the things that family implies, right? We're sometimes going to hurt each other. But we're going to spend a lot of time loving each other. And part of that is having those honest conversations and being able to say to each other, you know, that was a really, really horrible thing that you did. Let's figure out how to work through it. So thank you to each and every one of you for being part of this. And I especially want to thank Ron Brown, who is a principal leader that I look to on our national board around these issues, especially over the last 6 months. And so I continue to appreciate Ron's leadership and guidance with all of these topics. So thank you very much for having this as part of the convention.
Thank you very much. I just want to thank everyone. And once again, thank you. This is an ongoing process. Once again, thanks again to the facilitators. And I'll just leave with a little statement that I've come to understand within my own self is that I have to understand sometime that individuals don't understand. And when I come to that particular understanding, then I relieve myself of a lot of anxieties, and then I'm able to rectify a lot of situations in a peaceful and relevant manner. And I trust that you all do the same. So we will be sending out notices, notifications when we'll be having our next group meetings on these topics. And if you have any questions, anything that you want to state, just send them to our website. That's nfb-in.org. That's nfb-in.org. We'd appreciate it. Thank you very much for your time. Treat each other well, and God bless each of you.